Don't have enough time to stay across all the latest news? ABC News Top Stories podcast explains the biggest breaking news stories and why they matter in less than 2 minutes. So you can hit play and get updated while brushing your teeth or making your lunch. And it's always up to date, ready whenever you're ready to get across the day's news. Just search ABC News Top Stories podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, Australia's e-safety commissioner is taking social media platform Telegram to court.
So it is a fairly popular app. This isn't a dark website. This is terrorist content, the most notorious and dangerous and illegal, that's right out there in the open, so our kids could see this.
You're going to hear more on what Telegram actually is and how the commissioner plans to go after it. Then, culture over cash. European football nations say they'll boycott the FIFA World Cup.
It's huge. It's unprecedented that an individual federation would volunteer to pull out of such a prestigious tournament.
This is a major power play. This is a huge first move in dismantling this whole process.
This was a totally unacceptable deal. This is another example of terrible governance within FIFA. Infantino and FIFA have got a step too far.
We'll get into the blow-up threatening football competitions right around the world from the Radio National Breakfast team. This is The Breakfast Wrap.
And now on to updates from the world of tech.
Australia's
internet regulator has started legal action against Telegram.
Tại Australia, cơ quan an toàn trực tuyến của nước này vừa khởi kiện Telegram với cáo buộc
alleging that the messaging platform failed to remove pro-terror content, including videos linked to extremist violence.
Well, as you can hear there, this story has been going right around the world in the last day. So, on The Breakfast Wrap, we are going to hear from the eSafety Commissioner. Her case comes after a year-long investigation, and it'll be the first test of new powers handed to the eSafety Commissioner. It also comes in the same week that Russia put Telegram founder Pavel Durov on an international watch list, alleging that the app is being used by Ukrainian spies to organise attacks inside Russia. So before we get to Julian Mangrant, let's get a global perspective on this story. Mike Isaac is a Silicon Valley reporter at the New York Times, whose reporting often looks at apps like Telegram. And Sally got him to start with the basics, explaining how this platform differs from the others.
Telegram has been around for actually quite some time, and I would say it operates a lot like WhatsApp in that, you know, it's mostly text and photo sharing focused. Group chats are a big thing. You can do some level of encryption, which means folks from the outside can't, you know, crack into your messages and see it. But I think the main thing about it is how it's fairly unmoderated as a platform, or at least historically hasn't taken a heavy hand in moderation, which has meant, you know, a lot of different types of folks, you know, often those who do illicit behaviors have flocked to the platform, basically.
And what sort of cases have we seen of extremist content on Telegram?
It goes back years now, but anything from, you know, drug trade and trafficking to terrorist group communications, you know, ISIS, at least at one point, used to really communicate regularly on there. Child sexually exploitative material, like really the worst of the worst stuff used for this platform. And it's one of those things where, you know, governments have ways to see into, say, Facebook communications and or different platforms where there's a little less, let's say, lockdown communications. But Telegram has been pretty easy to use in terms of doing illicit things without a ton of oversight, I would say.
Telegram's very big. It has more than a billion users around the world, including 1.5 million Australian users a month. What do we know about the kind of people that it attracts?
It's fair to say there are folks who might use Telegram that also use WhatsApp, or Signal is another popular one that's encrypted, or, you know, in iMessage, Facebook Messenger. It is a chat app and a group chat app primarily. And so I don't think by using Telegram, it necessarily means you're doing bad things or exclusively a person who wants to commit illegal acts. But I think because of Telegram's history of being more laissez-faire with moderation policies, it has tended to have a bunch of criminal elements go over there. And I think in the recent years, they've tried to claim that they're doing a bit more moderation just because of exactly what's happening right now, far more intense focus from different governments across the world. But compared to, say, some other chat programs, it's far less intense oversight.
This case in Australia is being described as one of the most significant legal challenges against a major tech platform over the handling of terrorist content. How significant do you think it is?
I mean, it's a big deal. Like, I would say, other than France, which you mentioned, and Russia, I think only a day ago, there haven't been huge legal actions against Telegram, in particular because, you know, at least in the States where I am, it's an ongoing thing. You know, this struggle between freedom of speech, what should or should not be allowed online, how much policing of content should be appropriate. And so I think that's often something that has kept governments from going after some of these apps. But this is a big enforcement action. And I wonder if Telegram is going to start having to invest a whole lot more in its moderation policies. My guess is they probably will.
Mike Isaac there, a Silicon Valley reporter at the New York Times. So the person initiating this legal action is Australia's eSafety Commissioner, Julian Mann-Grant. She spoke with Sally this morning.
You're alleging that Telegram has failed to abide by Australian laws. What are you alleging exactly?
Well, this is the first major action we've taken under the RES standard, which is part of our codes and standards. And we are alleging that they failed to remove publicly posted pro-terror material and some of the most notorious extremist material that's already been classified. So the Christchurch atrocity, the Buffalo shooting, ISIS beheadings. So it's still rife with this kind of content. And I don't have to tell you that we're at a very heightened moment in terms of our security. The scars are still very raw around Bondi. And I'd also remind you that the Royal Commission has also received pushback from both X and Telegram in terms of putting forward witness statements and testimony. So these are platforms, and they may be doing more content moderation, and we would encourage that, but not to the degree that Australian law requires them to.
This case is a test of your powers to enforce Australia's online safety codes and standards, which are designed to protect Australians from illegal content. In your view, how significant is this action?
I think it's very significant. We're not the only government that's going after Telegram either. The French, the British, and earlier this week, the Russians. So I think in the international community, they're not viewed as a good actor. As you know, any of these fines and penalties have to be issued by the court. And this is why we've done a year-long investigations to make sure that the evidence is very strong. Again, we've been engaging with them for well over 2 years. The first 6 months, they refused to engage with us at all. We've fined them in court. We've issued them an infringement notice. They refused to pay. Now, this is just upping the ante and is much more serious. And if they don't comply, if the court fines against them, then they'll be in contempt.
Other than possible financial penalties, is there any other way that you can ensure Australians aren't exposed to pro-terror material on Telegram?
There is education and oversight. Now, it's considered a messaging app, but there are about 1.5 million visits by Australians each month. It has over 1 billion monthly active users. So it is a fairly popular app, even if parents aren't aware of it. And that is our concern. This isn't a dark website or an end-to-end, although there is an end-to-end encrypted chat functionality there. This is terrorist content, the most notorious and dangerous and illegal, that's right out there in the open. So our kids could see this. And if you think about what DG Mike Burgess from ASIO has been saying, most of the cases they're taking around terrorism are of young men between the ages of 14 and 22, and they're not being radicalized by associates in the real world anymore. They're being radicalized online. So there's, as long as a company like Telegram is delivering services and extracting revenue from Australia, they need to abide by our laws.
Telegram rejects these allegations and says that it will contest them in court. Is your office prepared for potentially a long and expensive trial?
This is what we have to do when we take an enforcement action. So as you would know, we've engaged with them for 2 years, so we know how they operate. We, of course, made sure that the evidence will be very difficult for them to challenge.
That was Australia's eSafety Commissioner, Julie Inman Grant, speaking with Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. Well, we're going to turn to the week in politics because a fair bit has happened over the last few days.
I've got a young daughter at home, and I couldn't be more proud to make sure she grows up knowing that I supported Jacinta Allan to be a world-class premier.
After speaking with my colleagues overnight, I've made the difficult decision to step aside as Premier of Victoria.
My first action as Premier will be to call a Royal Commission into the construction sector. In my government, integrity will not be optional.
I'm not going to give a running commentary on something I'm not party to. No payment was made. And I'll let the Commission do its job.
What about this dinner in Point Pilot?
I attend lots of functions. I attend lots of dinners.
One Nation is under scrutiny for late filing of accounts, a problem it has vowed to fix.
If there needs to be a coalition, we'd work it out then, but we won't be in a coalition with the unions and the big super funds and all the other crooks.
We are not in the market for any other coalition partners.
Inflation across a number of measures is lower than what the market expected.
The plan is for the fuel excise to step down as of this weekend.
Federal Labor MP for Solomon, Luke Gosling, has been charged with assaulting Northern Territory Administrator David Connolly.
There's a real concern that there's a degree of politicisation in relation to how this matter's being handled already.
And that was the Federal Labor MP Luke Gosling's lawyer, Marty Aust, rounding out some of the sounds of the political week. Well, to break it all down, our Friday political panellists, Karen Middleton, who's a journalist and columnist for The Monthly, joined Stephanie Boris, Breakfast's own political correspondent on Fridays, to look at that story with Luke Gosling.
Let's begin firstly with this story of Luke Gosling, Federal MP up in the NT, accused of assaulting the Northern Territory's administrator, David Connolly. Luke Gosling has denied these allegations. Karen, how significant is this story?
Well, it's very significant. It's not very often that you have a federal MP facing criminal charges. It's very rare, certainly while they're in office. And it's a very tricky situation because it's the nasty intersection of politics and the law. And, you know, I think politicians are in a unique position in a sense because they owe their jobs to the public and to their public reputation. So the minute you're facing charges, you're suffering reputational damage. And I suppose the question now is that damage worsened by leaving him in office while these charges play out, or standing him aside from at least from his envoy role? And in the end, that'll be a decision for the Prime Minister, and he'll be thinking about not just Luke Gosling's reputation, but also the Labor Party's reputation and which way to go to protect that.
And Stephanie, Luke Gosling's lawyer says there's been a degree of politicisation in the way this matter's been handled. What do we know about that?
So the NT Police have strongly denied that accusation. If you look at it from a political story here in Canberra, we have seen Liberal senators come out pretty strongly urging the Prime Minister to stand Luke Gosling aside in terms of his special envoy role. As Karen said, it is up to the Prime Minister. It is his final decision whether he does it or not. What we're seeing already is any federal politician that's been out this morning, they're being asked about Luke Gosling. They've all got the same line, saying it's before the courts, they're not talking about it. So it's a matter of also weighing up how much does the Prime Minister want all of his colleagues being asked about about this constantly instead of other topics of the day.
Karen, another story. The Prime Minister's attendance at an intimate dinner hosted by a billionaire family, which is facing allegations of tax office deception, has also been questioned. Has the PM been transparent about this dinner?
Well, I thought it was interesting on the weekend when David Spears asked him about that on Insiders. He was extremely reluctant and he kept on saying, I go to lots of private dinners. And I thought that sounded quite defensive. And I think on the third or fourth answer, he eventually conceded effectively sort of sideways that he had been at this dinner. It's fascinating that we've got the leader of the Labor Party, the leader of the Liberal Party and the leader of the One Nation Party all being grilled at the same time about potential political donors and where the money comes from in their parties. And in some ways, this almost guarantees that none of them are going to want to have a crack at the other ones.
And they're not.
No. I think Pauline Hanson is the one that doesn't seem to care so much. She seems to think that she can keep attacking them and nothing will stick to her. But it almost ensures that we don't get any further illumination of these things other than through the media. But, you know, it's interesting. This is the story of a 25-year-old billionaire who's the son of a property developer with links to China, and it's the father that has come into the frame with the Australian Tax Office facing allegations from the Tax Office that he'd not disclosed all taxable income and sent some money offshore. Now, the father wasn't at the dinner. You know, the son is a different person, but it's a window into how these fundraising things work. When there's an intimate dinner at a mansion in Point Piper in Sydney, people are paying, money goes to the Labor Party, and they don't really want to talk about it. And I think that always makes you feel a bit uncomfortable. It doesn't just happen in the Labor Party, but when you're in government, your pulling power for that kind of money and those kinds of dinners is greater. So it's often parties in government that can earn more from that.
Karen Middleton there, ending the Friday political panel. You can actually find the full version of it online, featuring the ANU's Mark Kenny, who hosts the Democracy Sausage podcast. He also talked about the New South Wales corruption watchdog. Well, an extraordinary sports politics development overnight. Member nations of the European football governing body UEFA have unanimously voted to boycott all FIFA competitions if a proposal to sell parts of the World Cup goes ahead. FIFA president Gianni Infantino says he wants to raise $20 billion of outside investment with a share sell-off to a private equity group. He's selling the plan as a way for member nations to make tens of millions of dollars. But UEFA has rebuked it, saying the World Cup is not for sale. Kieran Maguire is an expert in football finance who authored a book called The Price of Football. He now has a podcast with the same name. And this story is really right up his alley.
It's huge. It's unprecedented that an individual federation would volunteer to pull out of such a prestigious tournament as those which are run by FIFA. There's been an ongoing quiet war between Gianni Infantino, who's the head of FIFA, and Alexander Seferin, who's the head of UEFA for some time. They clearly don't like each other. And I think the creeping politicisation and the somewhat bizarre decisions that have been made under the premiership of Gianni Infantino has led to this, in the sense that I think that the perception of most football federations is that players play for the country and they play for the badge and they play for the shirt. And if money comes, and it comes to the national federations, but the thought of private equity making money out of that is a step too far.
If private equity were to buy a stake, where those funds that are injected into the game, where would they go?
Well, those would be split equally between the 211 FIFA members. So they would get around about 80,000 Australian dollars each as part of the initial distribution, and then the private equity company would get 20% of anything that FIFA generates going forwards. There's a concern and there's a fear that if the focus of FIFA becomes one of profit maximisation, then the logical thing to do is to extend the World Cup to 64 teams, which I think is fair to say has both merits and demerits. It makes it a longer competition. It is increasing the demands on players, but also it's likely to go to once every 2 years. And talking to people at clubs, who ultimately are the employers, they're saying that our players are coming back from the World Cup once every 4 years, knackered, is something that we can deal with. But if it's going to be once every 2 years and it's going to be a longer time away, ultimately, we're paying their weekly wages and we're getting nothing in return.
How much political sway within football does UEFA have, Kieran?
Well, I think there's a case for saying, and this is not European or British arrogance, that FIFA needs UEFA more than UEFA needs FIFA, in the sense that six out of the eight quarterfinalists were European, three out of the four semi-finalists, and the winner was all European. And if you take a look at the amount of interest that there is in countries, you know, France, Spain, Germany, England, and so on, then they tend to be the wealthiest leagues in the world. They tend to have the most high-profile players as well. You take them out, and who's going to be paying, if, you know, from a broadcaster's point of view or buying tickets, or even from a sponsorship perspective, if it's the Cook Islands versus the Seychelles in the World Cup?
What are the other regions of the world, how are they reacting to this plan from FIFA? For example, Africa, South America, Oceania, where we are?
Well, Gianni Infantino is up for re-election as FIFA president. And that would be a four-year term, which would have taken him until 2031. Now, formally, he probably had around about 200 countries voting in favour, including here. The English FA had indicated that they would vote for him. He'd had the block support of CONCACAF, which is sort of the Caribbean and South America. He had the block support of Africa. He had the block support of the Asian Federation. He put those three together, and that's 110 votes out of 211. So it looks as if it would have been a coronation rather than an election between parties. And there was no indication that there would be any opponent. But from what we've seen over the last 24 hours, the support for Infantino and the trust in Infantino, because all of this has been arranged behind closed doors and nobody's been informed until the story was broken by journalists, I think his popularity is waning, although he's still being very bullish and saying, if you vote for me and if you vote for this scheme, you'll get 80,000 Australian dollars effectively straight up. And if you don't vote for me, it'll only be 20,000. Now, some people might say that prospect of additional money might sway those people who are voting.
Kieran Maguire there, an expert in football finance who authored The Price of Football. He's now got a podcast with the same name. A little more context on this one, because you may be wondering when this boycott from UEFA will be tested. Well, the Women's World Cup is actually next year, and qualifying begins in October. The Women's Under-20 World Cup is scheduled for Poland at the start of this September. Out of the next five FIFA competitions, four of them are for women's football. You've also got the Under-17s Women's World Cup in October, and the Women's Champions Cup, this global club competition, kicking off in January. So women's football, at a whole number of levels, will be the first to be impacted by this boycott that UEFA argues is in response to Gianni Infantino's push for cash over culture. That's all we've got time for in today's Breakfast Wrap. Thank you so much for listening to all of those interviews from Sally Sara right across the week, produced by our crack team at Radio National Breakfast, led by our executive producer, Eleni Soltis. Kathy Van Extel produced today's Breakfast Wrap, and I'm Lixiton Dundon. More stories from us next week. Have a good weekend. I'll see you then.